Let's rock and roll.
Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Today, I regret to say that we are once again going to move over Senate Bill 62. However, I'm saying it at the beginning this time so people won't have to sit here like they did yesterday. My profound apologies. So we will take up the work session on Senate Bill 62 tomorrow. And at this time, I'm going to open up a public hearing on SJR 36, SJR 37, and SJR 35. Okay, Dr. Warner.
Madam Chair, in your packet today, I just, because of the similarity of the measures, I just put together a table. It's headed Property Tax Reform Proposals, and it outlines the three proposals. The key elements to it. The other thing I put in there was a couple of pages out of the Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring that dealt with Measure 50, and you can see some similarities in these bills and the kinds of things that the Task Force looked at. So that's just for your background. SJR 35 differs from the other measures in that it is a revision. And just recall that a revision does take a two-thirds of vote of each chamber. What it does, a number of things, it initially repeals both Measure 5 and 50, but it does replace that with a lot of the Measure 5 language is in SJR 35. So it basically is a repeal of Measure 50. It directs the legislature to establish a new local property tax levy system with the following criteria. Current permanent rates go into place. It gives local voters an opportunity to change those permanent rates, increase or decrease, with a 60% local voter approval. And it allows the temporary local options that are on the books at the time to continue until they expire. It does set up a statutory mechanism for local approval of temporary levies in the future. And it establishes rates for schools and non-schools the same as Measure 5, only those rates are one-third lower than those contained in Measure 5 in the Constitution now. It would be $3.34 per $1,000 of real market value for schools and $6.66 for the non-school component. So those would add up to a limit of $10. And, of course, the key there is the limit applies to real market value. Because the Measure 50 value calculation would be removed by the repeal of Measure 50, and the new system would apply to tax years beginning July 1 of 2012. 36 and 37 are both amendments, and 36 is a little bit more comprehensive than 37. What they do is primarily go in and change the exception value and the changed property ratio calculations. SJR 36 establishes a minimum assessed value equal to 50% of real market value for all property, and then it replaces the existing change property ratio with a 75% of real market value standard for all exceptions. So recall the major exception you see is new construction, but it also can be subdivisions, for example, rezoning. And so they would go, instead of to the change property ratio, go to the 75% of real market value ratio. And then the other major element to it is that it takes properties that are sold or transferred to a new owner and counts those as changed for the changed property ratio, counts them as exceptions to the calculation of assessed value, and then those would also go to the 75% of real market value as the other exceptions do, and puts a new limit, the new limits apply July 1, 2012 and beyond. And then SJR 37 is a little bit more condensed version. It does have the new change property ratio fixed at 75% of real market value for all exceptions, and it does add the sold or transferred property to the list of exceptions under the assessed value calculation.
Thank you for that. We're going to start out with a panel. Chair Ted Wheeler of Multnomah County, John Chandler, and I have Gresham here. I don't know who's here from Gresham, but Gresham is part of the panel. and Marion Haynes from the Oregon Business Association. Oh, I see you are here. I thought you were otherwise involved at this time, but glad to see you here.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and committee members. My name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the chairman of the Board of County Commissioners of Multnomah County, and I just want to say I'm really pleased to have this opportunity to come before you today and testify again on behalf of property tax limitation reform. In my mind, this is an historic occasion in a number of regards. I appreciate the bold leadership that you're taking by taking up this very important issue. I had the opportunity to address a number of you as part of the interim part of your committee in September, and at that point I gave a fairly technical presentation on some of the aspects of Measure 50 that I thought were most egregious, particularly the unfairness that Measure 50 injects into our tax structure. When I did have that opportunity to meet with you, I shared with you a newspaper clip that you may recall from Willamette Week, and it did a very good job of outlining really a tale of two neighborhoods in terms of the disparate impact that Measure 50 creates for taxpayers who have similar homes in similar types of neighborhoods in the same jurisdictions, but taxpayers who pay wildly different property taxes as a result of Measure 50. And I just had to bring this again because I love the graphic on the front. It says, "Can you tell the difference?" And it's pretty obvious looking from the graphic who is a winner under Measure 50 and who is a loser under Measure 50. But I don't want to rehash the past. I brought a different example today. At the bottom of the sheets that I've presented to you for testimony, it's a different analysis. It's slightly more complicated, but it gets to the same story. It's a tale of two blocks. And what we did was we looked at two different neighborhoods within the city of Portland. We looked at the 9900 block of Southwest 61st, which is just south of Southwest Taylor's Ferry Road, and we looked at the 5100 block of Northeast 16th, which is just north of Northeast Alberta Street. We call the 9900 block a low benefit block, and those are in boldface. And you'll see that we've described the Alberta Street properties as a deep discount block. As we went through and looked at the real market value, the maximum assessed value, and the actual taxes paid for these eight addresses, one thing just pops out at you. The first is that all of these homes are in the same county. They're all in the same city. They're all in the same school district. They all have effectively the same tax rates. But as you look at the actual amount of property taxes that they pay, it's wildly disparate. When we did the complete analysis and looked at these two blocks, we saw that those in what we're calling the low benefit block on Southwest 61st, they were paying up to 60 to 68% of their real market value in terms of their taxes. So their discounted tax rate under Measure 50 was 32% to 40%. By comparison, the deep discount block, they were only paying 15 to 21% of their real market value. Thus, the Measure 50 discount for them was 79 to 85%. So how did this translate in terms of the tax dollars that these very similar homes were paying in very similar jurisdictions with largely the same tax rates? It amounted to about $3,000 per year per household. In other words, $250 per month. So there's a substantial inequity that's created in our system under Measure 50. And as the analysis demonstrated last time, and I believe some of the analysis today will show, that inequity is going to continue to grow with time. And there's no question that it's going to become a problem because our taxpayers in Multnomah County are already noticing this issue. They're already calling us, and they're wondering why, when they look at one person's tax bill and their tax bill, why they seem to be getting so much less value for the dollar. At least the taxpayers who got the big cuts, along with the reduction in services, aren't paying for that reduction in services. But the low value block, they're not getting the steep tax discount. They're still paying for services they're not getting. And to make matters even worse from their perspective. They're getting fewer services so that other people can get a big discount on their property tax bill. That is patently unfair. There's another insult that's going to be added to the injury this year. Those in the discount block, those with the slow growth properties, they're going to find out this year that their real market value has actually declined by up to 20%. But that's not what their tax bill is going to show. They're going to see a 3% increase in the rate of their property tax growth, even though the real market value of those properties is dropping precipitously. Measure 50 is irrational and it's unfair. And that's why I strongly support your efforts and your leadership to take up this issue and begin to address it. Of course, unfairness isn't the only issue with Measure 50, because Measure 50 separated revenues from the real market values. We're also finding that we're unable to fund services that our citizens tell us they want and they expect us to fund. In Multnomah County, this has had a precipitous effect over the last many years since Measure 50 was enacted. We've lost over 600 jail beds, which is a 40% reduction of our overall capacity in our jails. We've lost 190 positions in our sheriff's office. We've eliminated the Forest Work Camp, where adult and juvenile offenders learned work skills. We eliminated the Work Release Program, where offenders helped to pay for their room and board. We eliminated two different alcohol and drug treatment programs and scaled back the opportunities in many other areas. We completely eliminated the school attendance initiative, which tried to intervene to keep kids in school and prevent delinquency and reduce services associated with our nationally recognized SUN school system. We eliminated an entire health clinic in southeast Portland, which for many people was their primary access to basic health care services. We eliminated our juvenile early intervention unit, which gets gang-related issues and gets kids re-engaged with schools and back on track. So we're not talking about reducing government waste. We're talking about defunding the very basic core services that our citizens most respect and more admire. It's timely that we're having this conversation today, because tomorrow I will be releasing the executive budget for Multnomah County. And while I can't talk about the specifics, I'll tell you that it's ugly and that citizens will again have to struggle with the reality that basic services for the most vulnerable people in our community, public safety services, human services, access to health care, all of them are endangered by the magnitude of the reductions that we need to take each and every year, and this year is going to be no exception given the state of the economy. Measure 50 is a very complex animal, as you're all very aware, and unfortunately that means the fixes are fairly complicated as well. But there's several levels of reform, ranging from the fairly easy to the more complicated. We have lots of options, and a lot of groundwork has already been done today by your committee in particular. The three options before you today, and I'm just going to describe them briefly because you certainly know the options, and there's plenty of information provided in your packets. The reset on assessed value on the sale of the property is a great option. It won't tax anybody out of their home. That was one of the major criticisms that led to the creation of Measure 50. Reset on sale would prevent people from being taxed out of their homes. It would align Oregon with other states that use acquisition value as the basis for taxation. Over time, it would build more of a connection between market value and taxes. And this is an important opportunity because it gives those on the left side of the political spectrum and those on the right side of the political spectrum something in common to hold them together to demand reform for Measure 50. Reset on sale is also relatively easy to understand, and it politically may be the most viable given that taxpayers have to vote through any changes to Measure 50. The second option would be to create a floor and a ceiling in terms of the taxes that people are charged for their property. In our tale of two blocks, we had some people that were being taxed at 85% of their real market value, and we had some people who were only being taxed at 20% of their real market value. What we're proposing to do is raise the floor so that nobody is paying less than 50% and nobody is paying more than 75%. It still provides a measure of tax property tax limitation, but it reduces the range and reduces the inequity that's been creeping into the system. The 1% limitation option was the one that was presented by Don McIntyre back in September. It has the advantage of greatly simplifying the Oregon Constitution by removing all of the Measure 50 language and replacing it instead with stronger Measure 5 type limits. Whatever option you choose to pursue, there's a couple of quick recommendations that we would make to the committee. First, any option needs to be tested statewide and carefully tuned. We all understand that Measure 50 created inequities that vary not only from neighborhood to neighborhood, but potentially jurisdiction by jurisdiction. And we need to understand the dynamics of those different jurisdictional impacts in order to be able to craft a package that makes sense for the most people in the state of Oregon. There needs to be a transition. Measure 50 was created largely to tame large year-to-year tax changes. If we transition this in over a period of time, it's going to be more tenable, particularly for those who might see modest tax increases as a result of any changes to Measure 50. Importantly, we need to protect the most vulnerable. Most states provide special tax treatment, or circuit breakers, as they're called, for fixed income and elderly homeowners. We used to do it here in Oregon. It's a good idea, and we should definitely do it again. Finally, I just want to stress that more research is needed. I applaud the leadership of your committee. I am offering Multnomah County and whatever support we can give in terms of analytical or research efforts to support the work of your committee to help move this forward. I certainly don't know personally when the best time is to bring this back to the taxpayers of the citizens of Oregon, but I know it needs to happen, and I applaud your tremendous leadership in bringing this very important issue to the fore. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Wheeler. Before we move on, I just want to recognize your work on this. I know you've been working on this for several years, and the committee returns the compliment about your leadership. And I think having the leadership from our state's largest county with a very complex county is wonderful. I'm glad you've taken this on. It's a daunting prospect. We were not able to get to it in any depth in the tax restructuring committee because we were working on more statewide, more general fund income tax related issues for the most part. But we intend to continue on with this. It's really reaching a point where we're not going to have much choice in the matter. We're kind of almost at a tipping point. So thank you for staying involved. We will accept your invitation to call on you. And
please do.
Really appreciate you coming today and appreciate the bills you brought to us today.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you. Now, Gresham.
Good afternoon, Senator Burdick and committee members. My name is Deborah Bond. I'm the finance director for the city of Gresham, and to my right is Seth Reeser, who is our financial analyst, has done a lot of the analytical work around the property measures 50 and 47 that bring us here today. I'm going to begin with just a little brief overlook, actually backwards in time a little bit, about Measure 50's impacts at a local government level, and particularly for Gresham. And then Seth is going to walk us through more of the analytical side of what did this really mean, as Chair Wheeler so well pointed out, the impacts now after 12 years have become very glaring. The intentions, of course, of Measure 50 were for predictability to our taxpayers, to replicate what was happening in Measure 47, which the voters asked for in terms of a permanent tax rate, and then to limit our annual growth on at assessed value. It also created the provisions on the constitutional side for uniformity of taxation. So it allowed for giving the same benefit to new properties as they came on the tax rolls as the existing properties. And ideally, in an ideal world, this would have worked if growth had been maintained at 3% over all this time. But as we know, the entire state has experienced a lot of migration, which has also created real values growing at a rate that is much higher than 3%, and we'll see in a moment. So intentions to the taxpayer were well said on the revenue side, though, for local governments. We've had to contend with a 3-4% increase with no provisions for asking the voters to increase the amount of the tax base that creates our property tax revenue. And so I'd like to turn this over now to Seth to talk more about what is the CHOP property change ratio.
We're just going to walk you through a very simple model that will illustrate...
Will you identify yourself for the record?
Sorry. Seth Reeser, financial analyst for the City of Gresham. I'm just going to take you through very quickly some of the basics of how it works, which will point out a number of interesting and unexpected dynamics that came from the passage of Measures 47 and 50. We'll start out with a two-house example, and starting in a neighborhood that is, since 1997, has developed rapidly. There's been a lot of infrastructure investment, a lot of gentrification, a lot of people moving in, a lot of improvement. Starting out in 1997, their taxable assessed value was fixed at, for Multnomah County, 74%. And then their taxable assessed value was capped at 3% growth, while their real market value grew by 12 to 15% every year because this was a highly desirable neighborhood. Contrast that with another house that started at the same point in 1997 that was in a neighborhood that did not see infrastructure development, that had was not marketable, did not see a lot of real market value growth, probably had a number of issues around service delivery, crime, poverty. They started out in the same place, but in some cases the real market value didn't increase at all because of some of the issues. Therefore, in 2008, instead of paying 34% of their house value in taxes, they pay 100% because of what happened to the growth between the real market values of the two disparate properties, which Chair Wheeler talked about in his block-by-block illustration of two areas in Portland. Where this gets interesting is that Measure 50 was designed so that existing properties were set at a taxable assessed value that was allowed to grow by 3%, which meant that cities, counties, and schools should continue to be able to provide the same level of service because that 3% fell within the inflationary factor that we experience. The problem is how Measure 50 went about to accommodate new growth. The mechanism that they used, the change property ratio that they used to assess new growth, was based on the changes in the real market values of the existing homes. So that what that means is when the assessor goes in and does the calculation in 1997, the change property ratio is 75%. A new house gets built and its taxable assessed value starts out at 75% of what the real market value is. Fast forwarding to 2008, because of the changes and the disparity between the growth in taxable assessed value and real market value, that same house built today, instead of coming on at 75% of its real market value, comes on at 50%. And you might say that, well, $250,000 in 1997 is different than $250,000 in 2008. But when you're talking about house, it's the same house that was built. And if you look at it in terms of real value, it's the same if you account for inflation. So what we're seeing is new houses that came on in 1997 came on at 75% of their value, and houses that are coming on today come on at 50%. Between our existing house example, what this ends up meaning is that neighborhoods that are stagnant or that have not seen real market value growth end up having to pay a higher percentage of their home's value in taxes, whereas neighborhoods that have seen rapid increases in real market value and seen infrastructure development pay a much smaller percentage of their pay much smaller percentage in taxes relative to the value of their house. It also means that when we go into the change property ratio, that new construction does not pay for existing service levels. And the reason that that happens is when you break down the change property ratio, it's one large equation where the denominator is capped at 3% and the real market value is allowed to grow at whatever the market will bear. And whatever the market will bear has been 7 to 8% over the last 12 years. Another way of looking at this is that a new house built in 1997 came in at 75% of its real market value, and then that value grew by 3% a year. Fast forwarding to 2008, that same house comes on the tax rolls, and we see it coming on at 50% and then starting to grow by 3%. In another 10 years, that same house would come on the tax rolls at a third of its actual value, and then that value would start growing by 3%. So what we're seeing that is new growth comes on the tax rolls farther and farther away from 1997, the taxable assessed value that it initially comes on at is decreasing each year. So each year a new house comes on, we're less able to meet service demand levels. One example of the inequality that comes up in the system is similar to what Chair Wheeler looked at, is we looked at two different areas within Multnomah County. The first is the Gresham-Rockwood Urban Renewal District, where the city has been going in and formed an urban renewal district to deal with some of the issues about transportation, accessibility, crime, and poverty. And when we took a survey of the the average house was assessed at, they were paying 60%. That neighborhood was paying 60% of its value is what it was paying taxes on, contrasted with an area in the same county, the Portland Pearl District, where houses and residential properties in that neighborhood were paying 40%, were paying taxes on 40% of their home's value. And the kicker here is that because the difference between those is that since 1997, Rockwood has not seen real market value growth where the Pearl District has. Unfortunately, that means that the Pearl District pays much less in taxes than Rockwood relative to their income, which means that the ability to pay of those two areas, Rockwood's less people in Rockwood are less, have lower income levels and have less ability to pay a higher tax burden, but they're the ones that are shouldering more of the relative burden of taxation. What this means for cities and how this translates into our revenue and when new growth comes on is that up until 1991, our property tax revenue paid for our public safety costs, fire and police. With the implementation of Measure 5 and then Measure 50, that was no longer true. And going back and looking at what the cost of providing services and what we were charging for, the cost that Gresham was seeing on a per capita basis was not increasing in real terms. We were still providing the same level of service per person. And what you're seeing here on the graph is that this is our police and fire expenditures in real dollars per person, and they have been staying constant. The problem is that property tax revenue per capita, as we get farther and farther away from 1997, we see more and more houses coming on demanding the same level of service but not paying for that level of service, is that the property tax revenue per capita in Gresham continues to decline. So our conundrum has been is to try and continue to provide services at a level that we were in 1995 or 2000, but that our revenue base has been declining and that people are paying less and less in real terms per capita. And this just isn't a city problem. If you looked at a county or a school district, you'd see the exact same problem. Their cost of services are increasing because the population's increasing and because they're facing inflation, whereas the inflation and growth, where the inflationary component is covered through Measure 50 with a 3% cap on existing properties, the revenue generated by new growth is not. So every time that we grow, we are less and less able to provide the same level of service to our citizens. And where you're seeing this, and one of the reasons that Gresham is on the edge of this, is that we're an area that has seen a huge population explosion since Measure 50 was passed, and we've also seen relatively high real market value growth compared to where we were in 1995. So in areas where you see large population fluctuations and large value and real market value growth, you see a declining ability of local government to meet service demands. And what this means and what how we have dealt with this up to this point is that we have been looking at other means besides the property tax to fund our services. We've looked at increasing fees, spinning off services into more of an enterprise model. We looked at cutting services, and we looked at eliminating personnel and trying to find productivity and efficiency gains. The problem is that property taxes were a huge part of how we met public safety and fire expenditures, and that each year we're seeing that property taxes are no longer going to pay for police and fire. And at this point, we have exhausted most of the means at our disposal to continue to meet those service demands, because we're running out of fees and services that we can spin off, and we've cut our general fund down to just police and fire, and are struggling to continue to maintain that level of service through our property tax revenue base. So Measure 50 created a number of very interesting consequences. One is that it made a very regressive tax system in counties, in that areas that see low market value growth and that have less ability to pay are the ones paying a higher proportional tax burden than areas and people who have experienced real market value growth that's been very good. It also divorces, as Chair Wheeler pointed out, it divorces any sense of reality of what's on the ground from how our tax system is based. If you asked myself why I pay more or less than Deborah would pay, there would be no other reason than that's how it was in 1997, which the farther away from we get from that, the less and less that system makes sense. And that's where you start to see inequality between similar properties. Same services used, same property values, but property taxes can be 3 to 4 times higher for no other reason than one area grew faster since 1997. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Deborah Bond.
Once again, I want to thank you for your time and listening to us and what we consider being a very critical part of our sustainability as counties or cities or school districts. Fixing the change property ratio, I think, is a really big first step in creating a tax base for this state that is more sustainable for us into the future. I know you have many, many other, I've attended many of the task force meetings, and there are a number of issues that you are addressing, but this one is incredibly critical, as Chair Wheeler pointed out, to local governments. I think it will maintain predictability, which I think is very important to the taxpayers, as well as try to tie our tax assessed value closer to our dynamic reality of our real market here. As Chair Wheeler pointed out in the options, although we don't have a lot of time, we do need to take time to do this as methodically and thorough as we can, as opposed to what has happened to us over the last 12 years. And the City of Gresham wishes to support any efforts the committee wishes to make in taking this forward also. So thank you again for your time.
Thank you. I think we'll take questions for this part of the panel now before we do the fire drill here to change chairs. So are there questions from the committee? Sheriff Wheeler, you've got three measures here, and really appreciate having a lot of options. Am I to assume that your favored proposal, if we could pull it off, would be the constitutional revision?
Yes.
Okay. That was short.
And I'll put a little meat on those bones. Mm-hmm. Measure 50 is complex. And so, to be intellectually honest, the reform would have to be complex. Mm-hmm. Having said that, though, I know all of us operate in a political reality. And that's why we're also trying to find options that are easier to understand, politically easier to digest, and perhaps easier to gain the support of the taxpayers who ultimately have to vote for this. That's why we've put reset on sale. You could also combine these. You could combine reset on sale with reducing the disparities, along with implementing some of the proposed changes, including phasing it in, doing some of the research that we need to do statewide, and protecting the most vulnerable populations. But as you all know, the bigger the package gets, the more complicated the package gets. At some point, support starts to drop off in terms of your ability to sell it to the public that ultimately has to buy it. So I personally support the more complex change to address all of the issues related to Measure 50. Now, Don McIntyre's proposal is one I don't fully understand yet, but it has the advantage of simplicity. It certainly addresses the equity issue, and I think it would potentially, depending upon how the analysis turns out, get at some of the issues about being able to fund the services that our taxpayers are telling us they want. So I guess personally I'd be really interested in seeing more analysis on that as well.
We did invite Mr. McIntyre to come to this hearing, but we didn't hear back from him. But he did show up in September. Senator Telford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having just served 6 years as a city councilor, I'm well aware of the structural deficit that various tax measures but I also understand the inequity of Measure 50. But at the same time, there are certain things available to cities to add to their coffers, many of which require a vote of the people. Have you implemented attempted any of those? And if so, what's been the feedback from the community on the approval of any measures?
There are Band-Aid approaches, Senator, that we can pursue at the local level, but they will never overcome the inherent inequity when it comes to the property tax bill. And that's why, for me, while the structural deficit issue is a thorny one, it's the unfairness, the inequity that exists in the system that's more troubling to me. In Multnomah County, 67% of our revenues come from property taxes. As you're all aware, statutorily, our options are fairly limited in terms of the sources of revenue we have available. But we have, in the past, had an income tax. I did attempt to pass a vehicle registration fee a year and a half ago, which never even made it as far as the ballot due to some hoops one must go through around the spider web issue around a vehicle rental tax. I won't bore you with that. That's for a different committee for a different day. And certainly we have some fees and contracts that we're able to renegotiate, and we do all of those things. But it's not nearly enough to overcome the fact that the vast majority of our revenue base is fixed in terms of its growth, and it's fixed effectively at three. I realize it's the assessed value, but in simplistic terms, our revenue base is fixed in terms of its growth at about 3-4%, whereas a lot of the services we provide, for example, public safety, health clinic services, mental health services, those grow at much faster than the rate of inflation in terms of the cost of providing those services.
Follow up. I understand all that. The question I was asking, what I was getting at was, is your community supportive of increasing taxes that they pay or fees that they pay?
Oh, I see. Yes.
To support city services?
Yes.
Or county services?
Our Multnomah County has historically been very supportive of passing what I would call targeted taxes. We've been successful with schools. We have a children's levy that focuses on early childhood and protective childhood issues. We have a library levy that's very generous that allows us to operate our 16 branches. So as long as the case is a solid one, you bet, in Multnomah County, people will listen to it. There is not the same anti-tax philosophy that might exist in some other communities where, regardless of what the service is, people might be more reluctant to support those services. That's why it's so important to do the research on a statewide basis, in my opinion.
Thank you,
Senator.
I also want to give my thanks to Multnomah County Chair Wheeler and Gresham for leadership roles in this. And to Senator Telfer, I don't think this is an issue of cities trying to fill up their coffers or really even having a supportive or anti-tax or pro-tax. This is really about fairness and equity. And I know where this, I know 61st and 16th, the tale of two cities or whatever, however you characterized it. And whenever we have those days in this committee where we set up principles of, you know, what is it, what I think there's even in statute what our sort of the mission statement of our taxation in this state, fairness and equity is always right at the top. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think this is about, not so much to, you know, we're short this year, so we need to change this. In fact, I don't think that has anything to do with why we need to revise Measure 50 or repeal it.
Senator Telford.
If I may, Senator, the fairness issue is the most important issue, and it's a growing inequity. Over time, the inequity, as these good folks from Gresham just pointed, that inequity is going to continue to grow, and people are going to become more and more upset. And we all understand that one of the fundamental tenets of tax policy is fairness from one taxpayer to the next. We have created a system that is inherently unfair and inherently inequitable.
And I think most people here know this, but there is actually a constitutional protection for tax equity in our Constitution that says similarly situated taxpayers have to be treated equitably. And Measure 47 and Measure 50 both contained a specific exemption to that. So we went into, and again, I want the record to show I voted against Measure 50 in this legislature and at the polls and against 47. But the majority, you know, went into this knowing that it was inequitable. And that's a very discouraging thing to me, that someone could actually pass a constitutional amendment in this state that says we're going to treat people unequally and have it pass. And of course, I think the other side of it is that the voters weren't necessarily aware of that piece of it. They were looking for the property tax reduction. So I just, you know, you say that that people are becoming more aware. Are you seeing that as well in Gresham, that people are becoming more aware of how inequitable things are? And what is their reaction?
Chair Burdick, there's a lot of the aha, I think. We have started doing a little bit of just grassroots with our employees as creating our first level of disciples going out with this idea into the community. We intend to do more in the next year at a community level with it. But each time we give the presentation, there's more people that then begin to understand things that they weren't aware of. For example, the fact that when property changes hands, the assessed value does not change, and many are not aware of that. So there's a lot of very positive, yes, they can get behind this idea, particularly when we go around the fairness issue and the equality issue.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. I think we'll move the three of you back and move the other two here, and then we may call you back because you're all part of one panel.
Thank you.
Thank you. You want to start, Mr. Chandler?
Certainly,
Madam Chair. You just want to stay back there and make faces.
No, ma'am. I can make faces perfectly well up here, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, and I hope they're not going to be hard questions on the three measures in front of you, because I was promised we wouldn't have to take a quiz on the specifics. I do want to talk a little bit about the need for restructuring our property tax system, and Senator Morris and Senator Burdick both heard this, as did Mr. Warner, during the interim, because I was on the Revenue Restructuring Task Force as well, and made this speech every chance I had, probably to no great effect, apparently, but I still think I'm right. The biggest financial issue in terms of taxation facing this state, I believe, is at the local level. Realizing we're in the middle of this budget hum at the state level, it's the wrong time to say this, perhaps. I don't think state government necessarily has as big a money problem as it appears. Right now we're in a recession. What we really have at the state level, fundamentally, is a spending and budgeting problem. At the local level, we have a structural defect. Every city and county in the state is going broke. It's just a matter of time. Some of the more wealthy jurisdictions, the Portlands, the Multnomah counties, are able to patch that up with cash flow. But the structure, as you just saw from the panel in front of us, when you have the income going up at 3% and costs increasing at 6 or 8 or 10 or whatever, you can't do that with a bigger truck. At some point, you simply run out of money. And both Measure 5 and 50, and they're very complicated and very politically risky, both of those, when we pass them, put this state on what I believe is an absolute downslide towards poor services, poor communities, and a significantly disconnected tax system. The reason the home builders are supportive of changing the property tax system is, A, we live and work in this state, and we think it needs to function well. But more specifically, and more selfishly, in a sense, we've seen the direct, we are the direct recipients of some of the inequities that Measure 5 and 50 caused in use of system development charges to pay for services that used to be infrastructure that used to be paid for in large part by the property tax system. As you decrease property taxes, you don't decrease the need. You simply remove one part of the money, the financial equation, which means local governments, by necessity, look at new development or user fees or what have you. And for us, with system development charges, those are in over $30,000 in some jurisdictions in Oregon per house. That's very difficult to provide affordable housing at that rate. It is unfair in a lot of cases. It's very difficult to pass on, particularly in a down market. And it simply begs the question of who ought to be paying for that infrastructure. That's point one. Point two, even with system development charges on the books, even with that tool available to local governments to pay for the capital infrastructure, there's no money for maintenance of the existing infrastructure. All you can do with SDCs is pay for new development going forward. You cannot pay for existing deficits going backwards. So if you have leaky water lines, sewer lines, parks that need mowing, you can't do that with SDCs. And in some jurisdictions around this state, there's one in particular I know of is sitting on several million dollars worth of park SDC money that they are not spending because they can't afford to maintain the parks they have. And so they don't want to create a bunch more new ball fields they can't mow when they can't mow the ones that are already out there. Therefore, they're sitting on money that the new home purchasers have paid to no end. And the third reason, frankly, is our business and our relationship with our local government friends depends on them seeing us as a benefit and not a burden. If new homes, new businesses, new structures were taxed, if the property tax system was differently structured so that as value is added to a community, the community reaped value off of the taxes applied to that, then they are less likely to be grumpy when new development shows up. When you're losing money every time new development appears, that's a little more difficult. We disagree that new houses cost, but we understand on the property tax side they certainly do. And we would like to create, to change that system. In fact, we have advocated in the past for changing Measure 5 and 50 so that new development paid a higher rate of tax. And I think I'm going to testify in this committee last session that we've tested the ballot title, makes new development pay. And it does right well. we thought about testing makes new development run laps, and that did pretty well. So, during the interim, I suggested again to ad nauseum my pet idea, which is to somehow swap the state tax structure around so that the local governments get the income tax in whole or in part and state government gets the property tax in whole or in part, which gives the state a stable funding source and the locals one they have more control over. It's more volatile, but there's also a lot more ability at the local level to create jobs, get the income. Whether that, I still think it's a dandy idea. So far, I think I'm a majority of one. The point is, we are committed to trying to change the system. There's another reason that I support this, and I grew up in a little town called Culver, out in Central Oregon, south of Madras, has its own high school. No real reason for Culver to have its own high school, but it does. Back in the day, we taxed ourselves $35-$36 a thousand because it was important to that little farm community to have its own town. And then Measure 5 passed, primarily from folks in the Willamette Valley, not to point any fingers. And the folks in the Willamette Valley said that Culver no longer could tax itself $35 or $36 a thousand and have its own high school. I never have, in the ever how long it's been since Measure 5 passed, figured out why it's anybody's business about whether or not Culver had its own high school besides folks in Culver. We need to change that. That, to me, is the biggest unfairness about this. We took away from the local taxpayers the ability to dictate or support or oppose local taxing measures. We took school funding, which is of all the services of a government, is probably the most intensely personal to a community, the most intensely idiosyncratic to a community. We took that responsibility away from the local taxpayers and local school boards, gave it to the state, which tortures you folks every 2 years trying to figure out how to balance that budget. And it means at the local level, there's really not much they can do to improve or disapprove of their local school activities. I think that we need to recognize that the demands, notwithstanding the logic, so using that term broadly, behind 5 and 50, the demands for government services have not gone down an iota. In fact, they have increased. What we have done is changed the particular, turned off the spigots on a couple of funding options. We still have the demand. The funding options are constrained. That means the funding options, as you saw on the pie chart, come out in other places. And aside from the SDC crankiness that we bring to the table, I think there's a broader social issue. And it kind of goes back to the old days if my barn burned down, everybody helped me rebuild it. We thought of ourselves as a community, and we functioned as a community, and we did things for each other that we needed. The more you go to user fees, the more you go to programmatic fees, the more you go to system development charges, the further away from that ideal you get, And I believe it is an ideal. The closer you get to, if you need an ambulance, you better have the money to pay for it, because I'm not going to. I don't need an ambulance. And I really think that when we've changed our system around the way we've done it, we've eliminated that ability to do for each other, to do for ourselves, to have a common good and a common pot of money to accomplish that good, or for that matter, a common good and a common opportunity to say, no, we don't think it's that good and we don't want to pay for it. I really commend you for having this hearing, but I would like to challenge you. This is not the first time I've been in this committee, not the first time any of you have had this conversation. And I understand, I'm not running for anything, but I understand this is politically very difficult. And I suspect you do as well, that if you really want to push this issue, some folks are going to get unelected over it. And I guess my thinking, as someone who is not running and doesn't intend to run, so what? If doing your job means you can't keep it, then do your job. And I really think this issue is huge. I think this is going to strangle the state more so than the income tax issue, more so than the current fiscal crisis. This is going to strangle the state's ability to compete. It's going to strangle the state's ability to have roads and water and sewer systems and comply with federal mandates and to have livable communities and all the things that we pride ourselves on simply because we haven't had the political courage to go out and ask our voters. We think these were poorly decided, whether you pick 34, 35, 36, or whatever the numbers are, or some other amalgam. Let's do it and let's quit talking about it, please. I'll help any way I can, short of running for office.
Or there, you had missed Jones' joke.
Be glad to take questions.
Well, that's all right. We're going to keep him in the room in case we start to get too serious. So we're going to bring him back up again. Okay. Marion, why don't you talk, and then we'll ask questions.
Marion Haynes with the Oregon Business Association. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and committee members. I warned the folks from Multnomah County that I wouldn't be nearly as amusing as my colleague John Chandler would be, and I'll try to be brief because I think really most of the points have been covered. The OBA, as a result of the crisis facing the state, put together a task force to look at suggestions that we could bring to the table for solving the statewide crisis. But as we were developing guiding principles to help us in our efforts, one thing that we identified and put in that list is recognizing that the current crisis should be used as an opportunity to fix structural problems that are the legacy of past policy decisions and ballot measures. And Measure 50 falls right within that. It's time to have a discussion about this. We're very aware of both the issues that it creates related to fairness and some of the structural deficits that it creates. In my past job at the Portland Business Alliance, I had the opportunity to spend quite a bit of time with Chair Wheeler, and it's pretty startling mapping out the collision course that this puts a lot of local governments on. I would suggest that the issues of the structural deficit and fairness are not mutually exclusive. John stated, what it does is drive local governments to look at fees, levies, and other things like that as a way to fill the gap that they have in providing these needed services that we all need and want. Whether that's on fees, whether that's going out for levies, which, again, are then impacted by Measure 50 and people get assessed a different rate because of compression and how that works for different properties. And don't ask me to explain that, please, in any detail. But I really do think that the issues of fairness and equity run smack dab into the structural issues that Measure 50 creates. And this is a terrific opportunity to take the time to look at fixes. We don't have any preconceived notions right now about what changes could or should be made, but we as well would be happy to participate in that process. We think it's important. Thank you.
Thank you. We will need all the hands we can get, and within the next couple days we'll be introducing a measure to create some kind of work group to deal with this issue in the interim. So everybody be on guard. If you volunteer, you're likely to be taken up on it. Okay, thank you. Questions of the rest of our panel?
Senator Shelford. I have a question. I don't know. Maybe John does have, maybe you do have the answer. Do we have any idea on how many, if we were to change Measure 50, how many people would have their taxes lowered and how many people would have their taxes raised? Do we have any concept as to what those numbers are or what those percentages are?
Anybody from Gresham or Chair Wheeler have any kind of sense from your areas? I don't know how thoroughly you've analyzed it.
Could make something up.
I'm game, John.
Madam Chair, Senator Tovar, I don't mean to put Paul on the spot. I don't recall we even talked about that on the during the interim discussion.
Well, I think, Senator Tovar, that it would be what you changed it to. We can tell you what happened since Measure 50's been in place. If you go back to the mid-90s, when we'd come through the phase-down on Measure 5, the state overall tax rate was right around $15 per thousand. Mm-hmm. You know, some districts were above that because of the bond exception, but the state average was around $15 per thousand. We're still right about at that level of assessed value, but of course the issue is assessed value is now much lower than market value. So if you look at our latest data on market value, that the overall tax rate in the state is about $9 per thousand of market value. So it's gone from 15 to 9 since Measure 50 came into place. And that's one of the rationale behind SGR 35 is that you would go to a $10 per thousand cap, which would be, on average, would put you about where we are, a little above where the current average is. But on the other hand, there's a lot of people that would get an increase if you were to go to that $10 because of where their what their assessment ratio is. Those that are closest to market value now would be affected a lot differently than those that are a long way from market value.
I think the question was, you know, numbers. I mean, how many winners, how many losers?
Exactly. I was kind of looking at this chart that Commissioner Wheeler had, kind of wondering how many would move in a negative direction and how many would move in a positive direction in looking at this type of thing.
Well, that would depend on that distribution. I mean, what we're saying is on average you would create about as many winners as you create losers if you were to go to $10 as the $10 per market value. So it would be roughly half and half depending on how that distribution is skewed. Now, of course, number of parts of the state would be affected worse than others because they haven't had much market value growth over time. So those are the issues that would have to be calculated. You'd have to look at the distribution on a property by property basis.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator, if I might, unfortunately, we're doing our part to get that disparity between real market value and assessed value closer than it's been in many years with the current real estate crisis. Now is not a bad time to have the conversation. Because what you're talking about, Senator Telfer, is a function not only of the actual tax or rate imposed, but this phasing in of it and the gap that exists. In a lot of our communities, that has collapsed much closer. If we'd had this conversation 3 years ago, you would have had a lot more screeching from people who would have seen themselves as a net loser. You'll still get some of that, obviously, but with now is an opportunity, I think, and I don't mean to make light of the crisis, Lord knows, but now is an opportunity to have, because of the collapse in the real estate prices, getting a little bit more down closer to where the Measure 50 assessment rates are. I think that's the sort of thing you can address through the calibration of the measure as well.
Yeah, and I'm glad you raised that point because as they get closer together, then you can tell people that, you know, their taxes are going to be close to the market. I mean, I think some people, I mean, I know I'm familiar with people who think that because their property value has gone down, their property taxes should go down. And you know, my answer to them is you can't have it both ways because it's already obviously very low. Other questions? Thank you both very much. Wait a minute. Before you go, John, I wanted to ask you, in addition to the system development charges that you're seeing on the increase as a consequence of the fact that new growth is, you know, it comes on at a steadily declining level, as Gresham pointed out, are you seeing any localities that are interested in a moratorium because of that? Or are you seeing other impacts of that?
Senator Burdick, I usually wear my crucifix and garlic if people are going to start talking about moratoria, so I wish I'd have known that. I'd have come prepared. No, we really haven't. Of course, a moratorium based on growth pressures is very difficult to do under Oregon law, thankfully. What we've seen, though, is people, local governments, who are very concerned. And you get into a very complicated argument about whether or not growth pays for itself, because if you look at the upfront payments versus over time payments and so on and so forth, jobs created and all that, we believe it turns out well part of the problem is a lot of the benefit of new development comes through purchases, income taxes paid and such as that, that inure to the state, not to the local. If you're building houses and employing people, they pay state income tax, which makes the state of Oregon happy or may not pay, make the city happy. What we've seen is a lot of concern, and frankly, it's reflecting itself in higher SDCs, higher permit charges, higher local assessments to try to keep up with the upfront cost of developing the infrastructure. Over time, property taxes, property structure can pay for things that still have an upfront component to it that has to be capitalized somehow under our current system where you have to do it with bonds because the property tax themselves can't keep up. So there is, especially when things were hopping, there's a lot of concern about that. Both ways, though. There was also concern in the jurisdictions of the state that were not growing, who wanted to see more economic activity, not just residential, but commercial and job-creating as well, longer term. But it, because of the tax structure, in my mind anyway, the proper role of new development got distorted because it became we were seen much more as a cash operation when we shouldn't be. New construction is a capital investment in the community, but we've been turned into an income-generating, immediate income, short-term income generator because the property tax system wasn't functioning properly in the long haul.
That's good. Okay. Other questions?
Question.
Senator Morris.
John, you, as a participant on the Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring Task Force, you know how much work we put into that. And the recommendations that came forward into this chamber, what in the world do we have to do to get any action? Now, we've had some very thoughtful recommendations, and there's a high probability that none of those will even be addressed in this body. And we undertake Measure 50 evaluation, go through the same thing, and we come back into the next session, and what's to change that chemistry to where we can actually implement something that is thoughtful, practical, and works? I mean, you can sense by my question a great deal of frustration.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I'm trying to figure out a polite way of answering your question.
Well,
the impolite answer is that you should do your jobs, which is to function as leaders for the state, even if that means getting unelected, like I said. I really think that there's an easy answer, an easy simplistic answer perhaps, but I think still an answer, that this body simply refers something out. That's point one. Point two would be we run an initiative separately, privately, outside of the legislative process. And I think, but even more broadly, I think part of what happened, this session is obviously very, very difficult because of the immediate crisis facing the state in terms of budget balancing and the constitutional obligation of this legislature. That is, I think, causing people to lose sight of the fact that there's, 25, 30 people in this body directly involved in that process day to day, and the rest of the folks aren't. There is still headspace, hopefully, to work on other issues longer term. I didn't ever, at the beginning of the session, I actually had hope that we could have those 25 or 30 working on the immediate revenue issues to some conclusion the body would talk about, and other group working on the longer term, let's keep us out of this jam the next time, and let's fix the local problem. Because you're going to come out of the session, hopefully, having addressed the state budgetary problem in a way that passes constitutional muster, at least for a few months, you won't have done a thing for the local problem. And I still am convinced that the local problem that Chair Wheeler and the folks from Gresham addressed and others is far more grating on the state and far more disastrous long-term. This is an immediate issue that y'all are dealing with. I don't mean to diminish it. The long-term problem at the local level is really where the state's going to stumble. I believe the answer is one of those two things, Senator, that this body sends something out, consequences be darned, or a citizen initiative, or perhaps with the help of some legislators goes forward. Those are kind of the two options open to us.
If I could just add, I do think that folks like John and OBA and the counties and the cities have a role to play, and Gresham spoke to that a little bit, first starting with educating their employees about some of these fairness issues and the inequities in the system and how it works. And I think people fundamentally sort of don't understand that right now. And when they do, it is sort of an aha, well, that's not right. And I do think that making sure that people understand what has happened and they understand those inequities and can sort of internalize that helps the process as well. So I do think there's a role for jurisdictions and other groups to help educate the public on just what this has done.
And if I might, I feel badly for my first impolitic answer, but I'm not going to withdraw it, but I would like to elaborate on it. I'm not naive, and this is not my first rodeo. I understand how hard it is to serve in the function you have, and I respect you for having done so. I'm not sitting up there, so it's presumptuous of me to say what you should do since you took the risk to do so. Having said that, I think part of the problem we face in this state is an unwillingness to confront our voters, our citizens, with the natural and proximate consequences of the actions they took through the ballot, whether it be Measure 11, Measure 57, 550. We're very scared of the initiative, and I understand the power of it. I've used it once or twice myself. It doesn't mean that we need to be paralyzed by it. And asking our voters, again, this is what you did, this is what the consequence is, this is what we believe the outcomes of that action were, do you still want to continue that action, is a very legitimate question to post out there. The answer we may not like. We may find that the voters are still fine. No, we like the current system. There you have it. But we owe it to ourselves as a state, I think, to ask the question.
Thank you.
It's hard to argue with that. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. From my very own city of Tigard, we have Craig Dirksen and Councilman Beener. You want to come up with him?
Well, thank you, Senator. Chair Burdick and the members of the committee, and my name is Craig Dirksen. I'm the mayor of Tigard, and I've brought with me for moral support Councillor Gretchen Beener, also from the city of Tigard. And I would like to begin by complimenting the previous testifiers on the scope and the depth of their testimony and the issues that they brought up. And I will try to tailor my remarks so that they will also complement the things that they have already said. In many cases, they've focused on the impacts of Measure 47, Measure 50 on the taxpayer. And so I would like to focus primarily on the impacts that's had on local taxing bodies, and perhaps I can put a bit more of a personal face on some of the comments that Mr. Chandler made with regard to funding and revenue costs. So I'd like to talk about what I would call the unsustainable effects on taxing entities of Measures 5 and 47 and 50. One of the things that I hope was an unintended consequence of those measures was that it actually penalized entities that were acting frugally before the passage of those measures. If you had a low tax rate, like Tigard does, and if you had no outstanding temporary levy, like Tigard did, when those were passed, you were locked forever to that small tax rate, and you had no hope for any other. Whereas other entities that perhaps had a higher tax rate that they maybe were not even using all of, or they had temporary levies in place, those got rolled into their tax rate, so they got to benefit from those forever, whereas entities like ourselves did not. So that was one issue that has to do with an unfair, unintended, as I say again, hopefully it was an unintended consequence. The other issue that arises is the effects of Measure 5, Measure 50 with regard to limiting tax revenue increases to 3% a year, with the belief that that would allow it to keep up with inflation and allow entities to continue to provide the services that they need to provide and are supposed to provide to their constituents. But the fact is that 3% has been not enough. And in the city of Tigard, over the last 8 years, between the 3% allowed increase and new construction, what we've seen annually was approximately a 4.5% increase in revenues. But during that same period, because of massive increases in costs and things like health care for employees, costs of fuel, costs of asphalt, things like that, our cost increases each year to continue to provide the same level of services that we've done has averaged about 8.5% a year. Well, you can't take in 4.5% more a year and put out 8.5% more a year for very long before that becomes unsustainable. And in fact, we're going through our budget process right now, and our latest strategic budget analysis shows that under the current circumstance, if nothing changes, that in the city of Tigard, our ending fund balance will reach zero at the end or during fiscal year 2014 will be broke, as Mr. Chandler said. And I know that there are other cities in the state who are even worse shape than we are, and also counties will be in the same shape as well. And I have no doubt that his statement earlier that eventually all of those local government entities will go bankrupt is absolutely true. So that's a personal face on that. As I looked at the hearing today, and what we've heard so far was primarily people making comments in a general sense about the concerns, problems with 50, and what should be done to rectify that. But I thought perhaps what you'd like to hear as part of this hearing on these three resolutions is, what do we think of these resolutions? And what do we think the impact of these resolutions would be on the current situation? So I would like to offer to you some of our own analysis that we've done on these three measures and what we think the impacts would be if these were to pass. And as we review the three, one of the first things we see is, it looks to me like these measures are meant to be, or these resolutions are meant to be, a package or complementary to one another. And we see a real concern if measure or if resolution 35, for instance, were to pass without either 36 or 37 passing. So one recommendation we would make if these go forward would be that resolution 35 would have language that stipulate that it would not take effect unless either 36 or 37 were also to pass. The other thing that we would ask the committee to do as they move further down the line is, as they look at number 35 and looking at lowering the maximum allowable tax, we would ask for you to go back and re-examine the tax limit numbers as they're proposed here, because our own analysis shows that if they were to pass as they presently show, that there are some taxing entities that would probably be subject immediately to compression. The city of Tigard would not be one of those, but we know of others that are closer to the limit that probably would be immediately impacted by that. We would recommend that you re-examine those tax limit numbers and see whether or not those are really the valid numbers that should be used. I'm not sure where those came from, as frankly, I'm not sure where the 3% came from either. It's not tied to reality. That's one of the problems with Measure 50 is, earlier I think Commissioner Wheeler said that this separated Measure 50 and 47 separated revenues from real property value. Well, I would suggest that it also separates revenues from costs. As I said before, 3% increases in revenue do not support 8% increases in costs. So I would suggest to look at the tax limit numbers. The other thing that would help ameliorate that would be if there's no, under number 35, there's no suggestion or consideration of phasing in the reduction in that limit. And one of the things, if you were to phase in the reduction in the tax limit, it would give taxing entities an opportunity while that phase-in was taking place to make other adjustments to make up for the difference. So we would recommend the phase-in of the tax limit reduction. So just very briefly, the three things is, please tie the passage of Resolution 35 to either 36 or 37. Re-examine the tax limit reduction to see whether those limitations are really what's valid. And the third is to, whatever those reductions are, to phase that reduction. So those are the things that we specifically see with these three. We see these three resolutions as being a huge step in the right direction toward a tax structure in the state that truly is sustainable for local governments, which we do not have at the current time.
Thank you. Councilwoman Beener, did you want to add to that?
Sure.
I just had one point.
If you could identify.
Oh, I'm sorry. Gretchen Beener, City of Tigard, councilperson. The one item that I just want to bring to your attention is, this would become effective tax year 2012-2013. That means that the first time that there would be any new revenues coming into either counties or cities would be in December of 2012. I have real concerns, having done some research on the issue of how many jurisdictions, whether counties or cities, will make it to December 2012 before they are in bankruptcy. So I just wanted to just raise that red flag that maybe you need to at least evaluate whether you may need to move this to a year earlier.
Thank you. I think the problem with constitutional amendments is they have to be, you know, you have to schedule an election and schedule a campaign, and I'm sure that's where the deadline came from. Okay. Are you on the, and I appreciate your comments on the specifics of the measures, but on the issue of equity, do you have any comments on how that's playing out in Tigard?
My perception is that the inequity exists, but because of the relative age of most of the construction in Tigard, and also the we're perhaps a little more homogeneous than some other cities, the inequity is not as pronounced as it may be in the city of Gresham. You had asked earlier who would the losers and winners be, and we anticipate that the vast majority of homeowners in the city of Tigard probably would fall between that 75% and 50% at present, with very few falling below the 50%. Our average right now is about 58% assessed value to real market value ratio. So the impacts would not be so great. There would not be a lot of winners or losers. Nobody would, very few people would see a major change immediately.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
you for coming. Okay, now we'll take Ralph Groner and Chris Brantley and Marcia Kelly. Bring the three up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Just for background, I spent about 5 years concerned with this some years ago and developed a system called Connect the Dots. So I had a state map, and I went to over 500 speeches throughout Oregon trying to teach the tax system because I was naive enough to think it would help. Then I went and asked every business in this building, would you help me fund a program to teach the public objectively? And I finally got, of all people, SEIU, our sister union, to chip in $10,000 to get it started, and we started Citizens for Oregon's Future. My point is, please, I've been involved with this as much as my body and mind could take it, and I don't want to get depressed because I'm kind of getting there, so I want to remain upbeat. My county, Clackamas County, I have to compliment very much, along with complimenting you, Madam Chair, because even though everyone else gets kudos, you held a wonderful hearing in Tigard that I was fortunate enough to sit and learn City of Gresham and Tigard and Multnomah County. Ted Wheeler, it taught me a lot, and that's hard to do, so I want to thank you very much. In my county, Clackamas County really represents counties in Oregon, in that basically if we can get rid of it, we're getting rid of it. Someone here used the word bankrupt. It's slowly happening. It's starting to much more rapidly occur. If a county service is still there, within a couple years, it'll be gone. Let me give you examples. Our park system is one of, that even the folks from Multnomah County love. Eagle Creek, Mount Hood, everywhere. It's used by the region. Those county parks we no longer could afford. So as a result of one genius young fellow in the park department, we created a very famous golf course that folks are coming to from all over. That now funds about two-thirds of our park system, so we've made efforts. Our extension services in Clackamas County was the number one agricultural county in Oregon. It's now fifth because nursery stock has dropped to the bottom. However, we'll be back up. Our extension services are so important to our county population of 300,000 that they voted overwhelmingly to vote for, support it with their property taxes. Sheriff's levy. Our people feel so strongly that this last time they did another five-year sheriff's levy. They approved it. Library levy, countywide. all cities and county, one library levy passed. I could go on. That's my county because they've been in trouble because of the ballot measures, and they found innovative ways to pick up the slack. And the only reason I point that out is even picking up the slack doesn't get at the question of funding county government. They're still in trouble. So I only want to raise a little bit different. I really appreciate, and I signed up on all three measures because, frankly, from our point of view, anything would help. But the truth is, you mentioned a task force, and ultimately that's the one way we're going to have to get at it. And we're going to have to continue to educate the public and take this out to the public. The only thing, I heard a quote from someone here that the structure, I think it was John, my friend John from the Home Builders, I'd like to add something to that thought. And maybe I'm wrong, and Paul Warner can teach you better than what my thought is. To the extent we continue to allow the counties and cities to fail, and if in fact they do face someday, 10 years, 11, 12, bankruptcy, what does that mean to the state general fund is something I've given immense amount of thought. And I can only say that to the extent assessment and tax, we went through that in another hearing, is weaker. And in fact, it's finally gone. Public safety's finally gone. Local contribution to district attorneys is gone. Then what that does, and I'm sorry, is put pressure on the income tax, which is inadequate in and of itself because of its instability, to fund our programs. At the same time, Measures 5 and 4750 have made the property tax unstable. It used to be argued we ought to have a property tax because of its stability. It's unfair. It's particularly grown more egregious now. I'm particularly concerned, as I know you know, with the elderly who may well live in a district like, I won't say a city in my county, but the fact is they'll end up paying proportionally more senior citizens in those areas than those who live in an area that's had the different kind of growth rate. Adequacy is no longer an argument for property tax, yet Senator Morris put out and paid for it, as you know, a poll that showed if we wiped out property tax to a great extent with the sales tax, even then we didn't get what we have, 50%. So even then the public, this is a poll on the governor's commission I'm talking about. So in the end, a bankrupt local government does total devastation to an income tax dependent general fund. They are tied together, and a specific would be K-12. To the extent we no longer can get the assessment, that tool we need out there to get the new construction, except when we do get new construction on the rolls, the fact is that hurts everybody, and then that puts more dependence over here. And what that hurts is health care, public safety. And what will happen is we'll ultimately measure 5 on a boxing match or a team, and Measure 4750 are going to square off against Measure 11, because finally Measure 11 and the prisons are going to face, hold it here, we've got more money we're going to need for community colleges, more for universities, more for K-12. That's going to reduce even Measure 11 money, and we're finally going to have a conflict of the constitutional amendments facing off against each other.
Ralph, can you wrap this up a little
bit?
Yes, I
will. I'll wrap it up to say I support your efforts at a task force, a meaningful, wonderful task force that will come forward with very specific, positive recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who wants to go next?
Yeah. Chair Burdick, committee, thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk today. My name is Chris Brantley, and I'm here as a volunteer with Stand for Children. And I think I bring a little different perspective to what you've been hearing, because I'm not going to try to build a rationale. I've gone off script. My rationale is on my script. You can read it if you want. What I'd like to speak to is the fact that there are a significant number of citizens in your state who get it, who understand what's going on with the property tax system and understand what's going on with the system in general. And I believe that there's a lot of education to be done in the state. I'm addressing my comments to Senator Morris simply because he asked the question, what do we do and how do we get there? And I believe that grassroots organizations such as Stand for Children can be a real ally to you as you start to try to educate the population about what the long-term effects are. I've learned an immense amount today, and the rationale that has preceded me far exceeds what I wrote down anyhow. And I think what I would like to leave you with is that Stand for Children is an organization that's over 3,000 strong around the state. All people who have signed on to Stand for Children because they are willing to work for lasting solutions. And I think there's other organizations like us. And I think that the major thing that's going to take to get this kind of thing to move is education and letting people understand what's happening and why it's happening. I think as soon as most people realize that kids are going to suffer as property taxes get weaker and weaker and weaker in this state, and schools therefore will suffer and their kids will suffer, I think people will get on board and understand that we need to do something about this.
Thank you very much.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm a public policy committee member of the American Association of University Women Oregon. We have 2,000 members in the state, and one of our public policies is to have a fair and equitable tax system at all levels. I signed on to all three today with both a favor and a neutral, because I think that one of the things that Chris just talked about, more education, is really important. One of the things that hasn't been talked about, however, our special districts, as well as cities and counties, and I can give you some examples. There are special districts who really are in trouble. I serve on the board of one of them. We shut down Saturday service in January. That was after we seriously reduced Monday through Friday service, 100 service hours in Salem.
I hope that's not a water district.
No. It is a transit district. We shut down Saturday service for the buses in Salem.
Thank you.
But I'm not speaking for the Transit District Board. And the reason we shut down Saturday service is we probably would have had at most 2 months of payroll and expenses in the bank on June 30th, and we have lots of silos of funding. We wouldn't have made it through. We would have had to shut down totally. There are some... Everybody has said a lot of things. One of the concerns that I have, again, someone said a concern about looking at the cap in 35 with the 334 and 666, and making sure that if there's a cap and you look at market values, that that cap is not going to, in the end, be a problem. The $10 cap on local governments has to be shared with local governments. When it went in 1990, you could buy $10 worth of goods. At this point, you can pay $15.50 to get about the same $10 worth of goods. So that's one of the concerns that I would have about putting something into the Constitution with a total cap that would not then allow you to take into effect other things that happen with the Consumer Price Index. As an example, our special district relies heavily on either natural gas, or we use biodiesel, 5% biodiesel, because it's just slightly more than regular diesel. But with the cost increases, even buying 20,000 gallons of diesel at a time, we have had major increases in that we cannot and would not be able to keep under the now 3%, or probably what minimal amount we would get in the combined rate of the $6.66. Our 3% assessed value growth doesn't keep up with the 5.8% increase in cost, partially due to fuel, but partially just because of the cost of living.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Okay. Excuse me. We also would be willing to work on grassroots education, and we have 2,000 members around the state.
Great.
5,000.
I'm counting them up as we go. Okay. David Williams, Gil Riddell, and Michael Novak.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. I guess I should throw my 1,400 members on the as we go forward. I want to lend my the support of my organization to the three measures before you today, as well as the aforementioned interim task force effort. The sooner the better, as far as my organization is concerned. The testimony previously given is certainly strikingly compelling when referring to the inequities on the local level between otherwise similarly situated taxpayers. I was struck by the comments you made, Madam Chair, about the specific exemptions in Measures 47 and 50 related to inequity in the Constitution, and I think that there needs no more compelling case than that. However, if that were the only compelling case, I think the case about the structural deficit in our revenue system is all of the more important for our local school districts around the state. Mr. Groner referred to the potential defunding of our county services around the state and the impact that that will have on the state budget. I think that the last 15 years of education funding in the state is proof positive of exactly what will happen. Ballot Measures 47 and 50 certainly did not contemplate how to handle a structural deficit in funding for our education system in Oregon, which is currently approaching more than $2 billion short of what your all's quality goals in statute require to be funded. And restoring some sort of not only equity to the property tax system, but as well some sort of ability for local jurisdictions to fund their local school operations, as John Chandler said, to allow Culver to have its high school if Culver wants its high school, I think is all the more important to our local communities to remain connected to their public services, to their public schools, and to have the choice to decide the kind of high-quality public education system they want in this state. So I would lend our support to these measures and can't speak more highly of the need to reform Measure 50 property tax limitations in the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Novak, do you want to go next?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Novak with the League of Oregon Cities. And a steady, reliable, and fair revenue system is paramount to the livability and continued growth of our communities. And thank you for taking the time to consider these important proposals that attempt to rectify the negative impacts of Measure 50. Now, as you know, cities provide key public services that are a benefit to everyone. That's sewer, firefighters, police, libraries, parks, and the property taxes are the largest single source of income for cities to provide these essential basic services. Now, of course, since Measure 50 changed Oregon's property tax system, revenues from property taxes are less predictable than ever. And their current inflexibility is decreasing the level of public services. The time has long since come for the state to have a serious conversation about how to expand the tools cities have to provide the best benefits to their residents, their communities, and, in fact, to the state. Now, this is clearly an important first step in attempting to return fairness and stability, and the League appreciates this committee's commitment to finding solutions. Now, as Chair Burdick alluded to, we also support the formation of a property tax limitation reform task force to continue the conversation started by the task force on comprehensive revenue restructuring, and cities believe the time has come to re-examine the property tax restrictions so that local governments, large or small, can more effectively meet the challenges of this economy and have as much flexibility as possible to finance community infrastructure and services. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Riddell?
Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties, and AOC is pleased that you're turning your focus to this. My remarks will be brief. In the year 2008, AOC spent the entire year, in fact, studying the property tax system. We formed a tax or revenue policy committee. We had the benefit of participation of Chair Wheeler and Commissioner Linda Modrell, who was also a member of the Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring. The Department of Revenue and the assessors generously offered data and helped us analyze it. We tested sample counties and we did some limited statewide testing. What we found was that there are deep, arbitrary inequities in the system. There certainly are winners and losers, and they're unpredictable where the winners and losers will be, and that the system is too complicated to explain. I particularly appreciated Chair Wheeler's comment that this does deserve some thorough study, should be tested statewide and carefully tuned, and I think that's the idea of taking a little bit of time and looking at this statewide will give you more reliable data, and we recommend that you do that. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. Is there anybody else who wanted to speak on this? Chair Wheeler, I'm going to give you a chance to give any concluding remarks if you'd like, and you don't need to if you don't want to.
My parents raised me with the belief that you should never pass up an opportunity. So thank you, Chair and committee members, and I was really pleased with the testimony that I heard today. It gave me a lot to think about. I heard some tremendous ideas, and again, I just want to say I look forward to working with you and supporting you and helping you in any way we can, and that goes for all of Multnomah County and our resources. So thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, that concludes our hearing. Any parting comments by the committee? All right, we are adjourned.